Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, April 22nd. Bond Committee decides on building two new high schools. Option calls for new high schools at new locations for $820 million to $900 million to replace Midland High, Legacy High. The story was written by Stuart Doreen. Around 95% of the members of Midland ISD's Bond Committee present Thursday night at Midland Freshman High School voted to build two new high schools in new locations that would eventually replace Midland High and Legacy High. Option 1A, as it was called during the meeting, was one of three presented to the committee. The other two included Option 1B, which would build a new Midland High School in a different location and the building of a new Legacy High School at the current location on Neely Avenue. The option receiving the least amount of support was Option 1C, which called for the rebuilding of both Midland ISD's two comprehensive high schools at their current locations. Architects presenting the options to the committee stated building new high schools in new locations would be the cheapest of three options presented. The cost to build two new high schools is estimated at $820 million to $900 million. Officials stated that range would include new $12 million indoor athletic facilities at each campus. The high schools likely would be located at opposite ends of Midland. A new Midland High would likely be placed where the Ranchland Hills Golf Club resides on MISD-owned land. The new Legacy High School would be built on land south of the Scarborough Sports Complex. Officials leading the meeting and Midland ISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard told the committee multiple times their selection for a high school preference does not set in stone that two new high schools would be part of the committee's official recommendation. Instead, it provides guidance for what the committee will do at further meetings. The committee was not presented options to not build new high schools or to just build one new high school and make modifications to the other comprehensive high school campus. Option 1B came in at a cost of $860 million to $940 million. Option C was presented to the committee at a cost of $890 million to $970 million. The Midland ISD bond referendum in 2019 that would have built two new high schools and made improvements to other secondary facilities came in at a cost of $569 million. Midland ISD officials presented information to the bond committee before the presentation of high school options that talked about grade reconfiguration and the benefits it would bring to the district. School district officials showed the committee reconfiguration that would put students through fifth grade in elementary schools. Students in sixth grade through eighth grade would be in junior highs, and then high schools would be for students in ninth through 12th grades. The conversations about options 1B and 1C included scenarios that included putting parking garages on campuses, the potential closure of Rusk Elementary if Legacy's footprint grew beyond a certain size, and putting a 3-to-4-story new Legacy High School building up on the north side of the current campus, which might have created issues with the neighborhood to the north and would have taken longer to complete school construction than the option selected by the committee. It was stated that the current site of the Legacy High School would be turned into a junior high campus if two new high schools ultimately became a reality. Midland High and Midland Freshman High School also could become possible junior high locations. the land where Legacy Freshman High School stands would likely become a site for a future school, it was stated. When asked about the potential growth of charter and other non-MISD schools, officials said with any bond program, there are unknowns. The scenario of out-of-district charter schools being built in Midland was presented to architects leading the discussion. Trinity Trial. First week ends with student's mother on stand. This story was written by Ben Schaffer. The trial of four administrators at the Trinity School of Midland, charged with professional failure to make required child abuse report intentional conceal, will continue into next week. The questioning of the mother of the student who reported abuse continued in the afternoon session Friday. With the mother there to confirm her side of the story, the prosecution reiterated the timeline of the alleged touching and meetings with Trinity administrators and the Midland Police Department. The prosecution introduced multiple email threads between the female student's mother and Trinity administrators. The meeting between the female student's parents and Todd Freeze, Trinity's Dean of Students, was discussed during the morning session. It involved the female student's parents telling Freeze they were outraged by the fact that Freeze had not notified them when he learned about the alleged assaults and that Freeze interviewed their daughter without a female staff member present. The defense also began its questioning of the female student's mother. Attorneys for the defense posited that because the student's mother was not present during the alleged events at Trinity, she wasn't in any position to speak confidently that her daughter was sexually assaulted. On Thursday, the female student testified that she was not touched on her genitals by the assailant. The defense asked the mother if she was surprised to hear that, and the mother said she was not surprised. According to the defense, the affidavit said the female student was touched on her vagina. The defense then presented a text conversation between the mother and her friend as they discussed the case. The mother sent more than one text message saying she did not like Adrienne Clifton, one of the administrators on trial. The mother also told her friend she did not know why Clifton was being charged with a crime. The defense questioned the mother about why she hadn't gone to police or come forward with allegations for 3 years after she discovered a text conversation between her daughter and her friend discussing the misconduct. The mother said her daughter did not feel comfortable enough to do so. The mother, in a text conversation with a friend, said she attempted to get Clifton's charges dropped. The defense said a staff member that the female student trusted was in the same meetings with Crystal Myers, another of the administrators being charged. They also stated that staff member knew the same information as Myers regarding the situation and was not charged. The defense posited that it is because the mother likes the other staff member personally more than she does Myers. The mother said she thought Myers handled everything very well. When asked her opinion on Shelby Hammer, another administrator being charged, the mother said she was ambivalent. The court went into recess until Monday morning. Friday morning session. The defense and prosecution briefly questioned Lucas Flores, who works in digital forensics in Kerr County, and was contacted to assist in the investigation of Trinity administrators' devices. He took the jury through methods in which digital forensics investigators use to gather information from devices. After Flores, a former Trinity student, was called to the stand, this person brought the female student's claim of sexual assault to Freeze. The former Trinity student claimed he went to Freeze in mid-September 2020 because he trusted him. He told Freeze that the female student was being touched inappropriately and talked to in sexual manner by a male student. The former Trinity student said Fries told him to keep the information quiet. The defense posited this was because it was important to not spread rumors about the situation. The student agreed. The defense wondered why the female student told this male student about her situation. The defense claimed because the two students never texted each other frequently, went to each other's birthday parties, or went to each other's houses, that they weren't good friends. The male former student at Trinity disagreed, said they were close, and the female student trusted him. The former Trinity student said on January 21, 2020, he went back to speak with Fries again after asking the female student if the inappropriate behavior was still happening, and she responded affirmatively. During this time, the school had been interviewing classmates about the situation periodically, he said. The male student said he was not called into Fries's office, but went in on his own. Attorneys for Hammer and Clifton asked the male student if he had spoken directly to their clients about the situation. The student said he had not. The male student said he approached Fries because it was the right thing to do given the information he'd received and that he was fond of the four administrators being charged. The male student was excused, and so was the jury. The female student's mother was brought to the stand, and, without the jury present, an evidentiary hearing took place regarding a waiver of release sent to the family by Hammer after the family had heard about the alleged assaults happening at school and decided to remove their daughter from Trinity. This waiver of release from the school included the reason for the female student leaving the school at the beginning of the year as student encountered unwanted behavior from another student. It also included a confidentiality agreement. The defense said the confidentiality agreement did not include any verbiage that would prohibit the family from speaking to police or the media about the situation. The judge ruled that the confidentiality and settlement agreement will not be permitted in this case, and the jury was brought back into the courtroom. The mother of the female student was brought back for questioning. The prosecutors asked her about her involvement in the Trinity community, her daughter's childhood, and early days at the school. The female student's mother said she was a smart and happy child until around December of 2019, while she was in middle school. The mother routinely kept tabs on her text conversations and found a text between her daughter and one of her friends discussing the alleged assaults. This led the mother to question her daughter about it. The mother then brought the information to her husband, she said. After discussing their next steps, the husband sent an email to Fries saying a male classmate had, quote, slapped and pinched her rear end, unquote, during school hours, and informed Fries that he had instructed his daughter to defend herself the way she saw fit if it were to happen again. The father also informed Fries that he told his daughter to speak with a trusted staff member about the situation. The father did not want the alleged assailant or her daughter's identity to be made public to protect their reputations. The mother said Fries did not respond promptly to the email. She also said she received a phone call from one of her friends expressing her sadness for her daughter's situation, which she did not know others knew about. The parents decided to show up at Fries's office in person and discuss the situation with him. Midland jobless rate drops to 2.6%. Midland reported state's lowest unemployment for third straight month. The story was written by Mella McEwen. Unemployment continued to fall as Midland's labor market approaches pre-COVID levels. The Texas Workforce Commission said Friday unemployment in its Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area, MSA, which includes Midland and Martin counties, fell to 2.6% in March from 3% in February, well below the 12.3% reached in May 2020 as the impact of the pandemic began to take hold. The rate is also the lowest since September, October, and November of 2022. A year ago, unemployment was 3.1%. Midland reported the state's lowest unemployment for a third consecutive month. Odessa saw its unemployment rate fall to 3.5% from 3.9% in February and from 4.1% last March. Quote, "Everything is pretty well stable," commented Willie Taylor, chief executive officer of the Commission's Workforce Solutions Permian Basin, which oversees 17 West Texas counties. As a region, the Permian Basin unemployment rate is 3.2%, and the state's highest rate is 6.4% in McAllen-Edinburg Mission. Quote, "Everyone is at full employment," Taylor told the Reporter-Telegram in a telephone interview. "The entire marketplace is competitive. It's not just this region. It's Dallas-Fort Worth. It's Houston. It's competitive," end quote. In the face of such competitive labor market, quote, "It will be up to us to recruit our high school graduates to stay in the community," he said. Not only is it necessary to convince the area's young people there are opportunities here, but he said it's important to address concerns like childcare availability, transportation, and affordable housing to attract and retain talent. "That tight labor market continues to push up wages," Taylor said. "Wages in the mining, logging, and construction sector alone, which includes the oil and gas sector, were $946.2 million in the third quarter of 2022. Quote, "I hope these numbers attract new workers, workers who really want to work," Taylor said. Midland's civilian labor force inched higher in March, rising to 114,569 from 114,479 in February, but has grown by 7,761 from the 106,808 reported last March. The number of employed Midlanders rose by almost 500 to 111,535 from 111,056 in February, and is 8,000 more than the 103,507 employed a year ago. The number of unemployed Midlanders fell by almost 400 from February to March to 3,034. That's 267 less than the 3,301 unemployed last March. The total non-farm job count dipped by 100 to 118,700, with little change in the industrial sectors. The mining, logging, and construction sector, the leisure and hospitality sector, and government sector each added 100 jobs over the month. But those gains were overshadowed by the loss of 300 jobs in the trade, transportation, and utilities sector, and 200 jobs in the professional and business services sector. For the 12 months from March 2022 to March 2023, Midland has added 10,400 jobs for a growth rate of 9.6%. Job creation has been dominated by the mining, logging, and construction sector, with 6,100 new jobs for a growth rate of 17.8%. Trade, transportation, and utilities added 800 jobs. The mining sector and professional and business services sector each added 700 new jobs, followed by leisure and hospitality with 600 new jobs. Private education and health services and the other services sector each added 400 new jobs. Financial activities created 300 jobs, while the information sector and government sector each added 200 jobs. Statewide, the unemployment rate held at 4%. Texas set new records, reporting the largest civilian labor force and greatest number of people employed in state history. The seasonally adjusted civilian labor force increased by 78,800 to reach a series high 14,898,100 people. Texas added 28,600 positions to reach another series high job count at 13,839,200 total non-farm jobs. Since March 2022, 575,100 positions have been added.
Governor Abbott reappoints Ellen Ramsey to Humanities Texas. Governor Greg Abbott reappointed Midland's Ellen Ramsey to Humanities Texas. As the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, Humanities Texas conducts and supports public programs in history, literature, philosophy, and other humanities disciplines which strengthen Texas communities by cultivating the knowledge and judgment that represent democracy demands of its citizens. Humanities Texas is one of 56 nonprofit state and jurisdictional humanities councils in the United States. Ramsey is the executive director of the Permian Road Safety Coalition, a partner of Ramsey Petroleum LP, and a civic volunteer. She is a 2016 gubernatorial appointee to the Humanities Texas Board, where she serves as Public Programs Chairman and Grants Committee Member. She also serves on the boards of the Midland Chamber of Commerce, Midland Memorial Hospital Board of Trustees, City of Midland Hotel Motel Tax, and Midland Habitat. Additionally, she is a Junior League of Midland sustainer and PTA lifetime member. Ramsey has served on the boards for the Midland County Public Library Foundation, George W. Bush Childhood Home, Pink the Basin, Midland County Republican Party, and I-20 Wildlife Preserve. She previously was Community Relations Director for Norfleet Strategies and District Director for former State Senator Kel Seliger. Ramsey attended Baylor University and earned a BA in Sociology from the University of Texas Permian Basin. She and her husband, Midland County Commissioner Scott Ramsey, have two children, Rachel and Tucker. MC Diesel Technology student is first person to enter national program. Current Midland College diesel technology student Jesse Hills is the first person in the nation to enter the Sunbelt Rentals Specialty Technician Apprentice Co-op Program. With more than 1,200 locations in the United States, Sunbelt provides expertise and reliable equipment for the energy industry, including generators, cooling trailers, light towers, and more. Hills is currently completing her first year in the MC Diesel Technology Program. Jessie is detail-oriented, and she quickly learned the principles and systems used in the industry, Eric Gutierrez, MC Diesel Technology Program Chair, said. She also excelled in hands-on applications on a wide variety of industry-standard machines and equipment. I have no doubt that she will do well during her apprenticeship with Sunbelt and beyond. Sunbelt is already calling her the poster child for their national co-op program. When they posted her picture on LinkedIn with some of the members of Sunbelt's Permian Basin team, the post received over 1,000 comments welcoming her. Midland College names Alum of the Year. On March 31st, the Midland College, MC, Alumni Association leadership team presented Cody Vasquez with the 2023 Alum of the Year Award. Vasquez, a 2016 graduate of early college high school at Midland College, currently works as an admissions counselor at Angelo State University and owns the award-winning Vasquez Development Group in San Angelo that provides executive leadership training to high school students, college students, and young professionals. He recently received the San Angelo Chamber of Commerce Award for commitment to diversity and community impact. In 2022, he was a recipient of the San Angelo 20 Under 40 Award given to influential young professionals who exemplify occupational merit and servant leadership and who exude remarkable personal qualities. He credits his time at MC for setting the example of how faculty should teach and staff should care about the students. He even found personal happiness at MC when he met his wife, Lizette, MC class of 2017. Cody and Lizette are the proud parents of a one-year-old son. This past fall, Vasquez helped to coordinate the first ASU at MC Day, where ASU admissions counselors met with current MC students and discussed transfer opportunities. His favorite part of this event was returning to his alma mater, ECHS, at MC and sharing his experiences. The concepts of education in today's world and tips on continuing the educational journey. I learned the importance of education at a young age, Vasquez said. Like most first-generation students, I wanted to attend college but didn't know how I could make that happen. When I was 13, I heard about ECHS at MC and immediately knew that was how I was going to take the first steps towards a college degree. Through Vasquez Development Group, Cody coordinates Tomorrow's Leaders fundraising campaign to raise funds for higher education scholarships. He also volunteers on many local nonprofit boards in San Angelo and is a member of Concho Cadre and Young Professionals of San Angelo. When asked what he liked most about community involvement, Vasquez said, "I enjoy seeing people achieve something greater than they thought possible." After ECHS at MC, Vasquez attended ASU, where he received both a bachelor's degree and an MBA degree. In 2020, Delta Sigma Pi Business Fraternity named him National Collegiate of the Year for his leadership and commitment to the business community. "Even though I now live in San Angelo, Midland is my hometown, and I know firsthand the value of Midland College, the wonderful impact it has on the Midland community, and the opportunities it provides for students," Vasquez stated. "I am honored to be the 2023 Midland College Alum of the Year."
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Saturday, April 22nd. Robbie Willis Schrum, age 80, of Midland, passed away on April 17th. She was born in Luling, Texas, to Laura and Elmo Willis on March 1, 1943. She married Jesse H. Schrum, Jr. on August 17, 1979, and they were married for 43 years. Robbie Schrum was preceded in death by her parents and brother Ezel Willis and his wife Hazel. She is survived by her husband, Jesse H. Schrum, Jr., three daughters, Brenda Crowhurst, Morgan Benton and husband Matthew, and Robbie Prager and husband Matt, a brother, Ray Willis, and his wife Lola, two nieces, five grandchildren, and seven great-grandchildren. Services are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. To place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com. Memorials may be given to Gifts of Hope of Midland. John D. Savage, age 80, of Midland, was life-flighted to Covenant Hospital in Lubbock on March 9th. He died there on March 13th. Services are currently pending.
Hi, friends. This is Julie, reading from the My OA And it is Monday, April 24th, 2023. The Economist, The Counting Man. Dr. Steve Murdoch, one foremost Texas demographer and my dear friend, recently passed away. Steve had a distinguished career spanning endowed positions at three major universities, designated as the state demographer, and a stint at the director of U.S. Census Bureau. More important, however, he was the clarion voice proclaiming a reality that we needed to hear. Over 40 years, Steve and I undoubtedly shared hundreds of platforms and hearing rooms and many more hours of lively conversation about my native and his adoptive state. We often collaborated on projects. He had a wonderful wit that was about as dry as his subject matter. Whenever I was asked to assemble a group to explore the future of Texas, he was my first call, and he inevitably said yes. I tried to reciprocate. Our research approaches were vastly different, but we were bound by unwavering belief that the results were generated by neither liberal nor conservative, Republican nor Democrat. They are simply the unbiased product of careful analysis. One of our more humorous interactions occurred as we being named the first state demographer by the legislature. I always testified supporting his request for additional funding, but in this instance, he asked if I would prepare a brief analysis showing the value of his efforts. For decades afterward, I called The Economist Impact of Steve Murdoch's Study. That apparently annoyed him greatly, which after all was the point, but I think, hope, that he had secretly enjoyed it. In fact, it made its way through some of his infamous defense slide presentations. As noted, demography is the most scintillating of sciences, especially in the study of how many of us are born, how many die, and where we live in between. What Steve found in his tedious effort was, however, a gripping tale of obstacles and opportunity. Texas remains in the midst of massive changes in the sheer size of its population. The seismic shift occurring in age, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and urban-suburban concentration. These movements have profound policy implications for public and higher education, workforce preparedness, health care access, affordability, infrastructure, water resources, rural viability, metropolitan area livability, and myriad of other issues. Through prolific writing and speaking, Steve kept these facts ever before us, reminding us that the stakes were immeasurably high. It is no exaggeration that the demographic pattern, which he painstakingly chronicled, simultaneously represented the greatest potential asset in those formidable challenge facing Texas. Steve Murdoch meticulously documented the half of the equation that we don't control. Our future prosperity, indeed, our future sustainability, depends on a response. The messenger will be sorely missed, but the message will endure and must be heeded. Stay safe. Bonham assistant principal finds a reward in her job. Josie Mata, calling has always been education. The assistant principal at Bonham Middle School has devoted her life to it. Recently, Mata won Texas Elementary Principal and Supervisors Association, TEPSA, Region 18 Assistant Principal of the Year honors. She also won the award in 2017-2018 when she was an assistant principal at the Midland Elementary School. Receiving this award is a great honor. I have to thank my staff, parents, and students for this award. I would not be where I am today without them, Mata said. It is truly a great honor in being recognized both in ECISD and MISD. This is her first year at Bonham and her first year in middle school. Mata's been an educator for 27 years, 21 with Ector County ISD. She has mainly worked in Odessa and Midland, but also worked in Irving. The native Odessan always thought she would go into education. When I was a student, I was utilized a lot to tutor other students, especially if they were coming in from Mexico or they couldn't speak English. So I kind of would sit back in the corner and let them translate and help them with the teacher couldn't speak Spanish to them, Mata said. She attended Odessa College in University of Texas, Permian Basin, earning a bachelor in Spanish with a minor in multicultural studies and a master in educational leadership, both from UTPB. Mata said she would never dream she would wind up as administration. They always encouraged me, but I was really hesitant. God works in special ways. There was one year that he decided that I would need to apply, and I applied. It was funny because I applied and took the first interview. I said, oh, it's just for practice. I walked out of there, and I had barely gotten into my car when they said, we're recommending you. I guess that's where my calling is, she added. Mata said she enjoyed working with students and in the impression she made was making on them. When they're having a rough moment and they come in and see me, they ask for the assistant that's kind of pleased me. I'm here to assist, and I want them to see that they can reach for the stars, Mata said. A lot of students who come in to her don't think they can ever go far in life. She tells them they can, but they have to work hard at it. Everyone has to start somewhere, but you have to work hard, so it's just kind of instilled in that. And then with teachers leading them towards success, making them to want to achieve more, Mata said. She's working with three teachers right now that are trying to find leadership roles and kind of mentoring them on how they're following her lead. Bonham has 867 students in grades 6 through 8 and more than 75 staff members. Mata said you never see her slowing down or stopping. I'm always working on something, just nonstop. I hit the door ready. Whenever I walk in at 8 o'clock, I usually kind of mingle out in front and do duty, greet the students, and then I come in. It doesn't stop until about 5:15. Usually I work about come to work about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night before I go home, she added. Mata, who is a widow, has two sons, Louis Alfredo and Sergio Xavier. Her late husband was Louis. A lot of times assistant principals are seen as enforcers. I'm classified as one of the strict ones, she says, the mean ones, she said. It's not so much putting the fear in students as it wanting them to meet high expectations. Whether you believe it or not, they want to please you, and they will rise to the occasion, Mata said. They feel that they have a strong bond, a good relationship. They come to see me, we visit or we talk. In the evenings, we hold once-a-month parent meetings, and we invite the students, she added. They always try to make the parents and students feel welcome, Mata said. Juan Dominguez worked with Mata at Bonham when he was principal there and moved over to become principal at Alamo Junior High in Midland. I think Miss Mata has done a tremendous job working with our students, teachers, and parents. She has not only been recognized at the elementary level, but now at the middle school and TEPSA Regional 18 AP Teacher of the Year. I think that anyone who knows or has worked with Miss Mata knows she's dedicated and hard worker, or always puts her students first. I think she is a huge part of our success and our great role model for our kids. I'm truly proud that she's receiving this recognition. I look forward to seeing her run her own campus in the future, Dominguez said. Dr. Sarah Chow receives the Golden Windmill Award for Research Grant by Olivia Escarciga, Communications and Recruitment Specialist. Special from UTPB. Meet Dr. Sarah Chow, Assistant Professor in the Department of Communications at UTPB and the 2022 recipient of the Golden Windmill Award by La Mancha Society. The award was accomplished with a generous research grant, which will aid Dr. Chow in her research project on the border between foreign and domestic brides, North Korean refugee women, and intersectability. Chow plans to visit South Korea this summer to complete interviews and explore the international section of North Korea women and South Korean as refugees. This is such an honorable, meaningful moment for me, especially because the award encourages junior faculty research. UTPB created this possibility to encourage scholarly and creative pursuit. I'm very honored to be a part of this legacy and have support to continue my efforts in producing and promoting research. Chow received UTPB 3 years ago after completing her Ph.D. in Social Interaction and Culture at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. When she earned her Ph.D., she was looking for a place when she could continue her research and teach students. At UTPB, Chow teaches general courses in human communication, including public speaking, intercultural, interpersonal, and small group communications. In my class, no matter what I teach, diversity, equity, the inclusion are the utmost importance. I respect the outcomes of self-learning. Therefore, class discussion is the core of my teaching. I trust my students' capabilities and their value, their diverse perspectives. My job in class is to invite them to challenge and doubt the ideas they have taken for granted. Dr. Chow was born and raised in South Korea and worked for public companies for most of her 20s. Since childhood, she's enjoyed reading, writing, and editing texts. After attending a professional school to learn more about e-books, she became interested in communication studies in general. She then moved to the United States and continued her education in communication studies. Dr. Chow loves teaching at UTPME primarily because her students, department, and colleagues all value her work and support her research goals. She believes through research, related activities, professors are exposed to new and updated knowledge, which enables them to share with students in class and help them do their own research. I've encouraged and monitored my students to share their learning outcomes at UTPB Undergraduate Research Day, and they have provided me right. I believe that research and teaching cannot be separated. I find this dynamic is valued and encouraged in the Department of Communication at UTPB. Master Gardeners, Familiar Prairie Grasses Make Achieving a Natural Landscape Easier, by Emily Alsmeyer and Debbie Rowland, Master Gardeners. Prairie used to cover a swath of America from Mexico to Canada, but not all prairies are the same. Different conditions dictate each prairie ecosystem, and thus plants and animals exist in each type of prairie. Shortgrass prairies are semi-arid and receive less rain than tall grass prairies. They are characterized by ankle-high grass like buffalo grass. Tall grass prairies receive more water and are characterized by taller plants, some reaching 8 feet in height. We are fortunate to have remnants of both shortgrass and tall grass prairies in Texas. In West Texas, we live on what used to be shortgrass prairie. However, in our yards, we use tall grass prairie grasses because of the horizontal interest. They added interest and movement to landscape because of their size, texture, form, and color. These are characteristics that are not alike a rock star designs such as Pete O'Dulf, as he wrote in our article on planning for year-round color. Achieving the effect of a natural landscape takes planning and a design system, but that becomes easier if you're familiar with the prairies and the plants that do this naturally. Previously, we have written in detail about the shortgrass prairie grasses, side oats gamma, January 24, 2021, and curly mesquite, 8/1/22, and tall grass prairie grass, deer molly, 1/19/21. But here are some characteristics that might make a standout in the urban prairie. Side oats gamma, Butola catapula, is an iconic Texas plant, the state grass of Texas, and ranges from Canada to Argentina. It's a staple grass on our short Midwest prairies. Its size, erect shape, and seasonal color form spring and summer green to fall purple to red to winter tans are perfect for an urban prairie. But what captures one's interest are the small oats that seeds, which occur along one side of the stem. Red and yellow tinged purple flowers give rise to these seeds, which persist in the winter. Curly mesquite, Hilaria bulgari, represents buffalo grass, but with a different color and narrow leaves that give it a wavy texture. Like buffalo grass, it can be used as a turf grass along or combined with other native short grasses, prairie grasses, to create a low area or turf within the urban prairie. Deer molly, Mulberria riggins, is often described as a tidy and well-behaved version of pampas grass, but in so much more. Deer molly does have a beautiful arching fountain-like effect in the characteristic pampas grass, but it's not invasive or toxic, nor can its leaves be cut. What deer molly does have its color and structural season interest throughout the year, whether it's accent plant or in groupings. Slender leaves transition light tall by the fall and the spring. The flower spikes start out yellowish purple in the spring, which matures to graceful slender plumes by fall. An urban prairie is so much more than a Bermuda grass lawn. It is a place for life throughout the year. Check out the sites as you decide on your own short grass prairie. tinyurl.com/yt2tkkp4 or tinyurl.com/365vvspz. If you have questions, call the AgriLife office in Odessa at 498-4071 or in Midland, 686-4700. Additional information and our blog for access to past articles is available at westtexasgardening.org. Click on resources. OC Projects on Pace. Things are looking good for Odessa College Wood Health Science Center to open in spring of 2024, and hoping the James Seacrest Stadium will open in September. The stadium will have an outdoor facility next to it. The college got a grant from Blue Cross Blue Shield of up to $50,000 will help pay for it. The track will open at the same time. Everything's looking good, Vice President of Administration Services Kim Zartner said. They're doing some really phenomenal work. As soon as it's ready, we'll go and we'll open it up for different uses throughout the community and for our own events. For the Health Sciences building, everything is going well. That's why the college has been buying equipment for it. Normally, you don't start buying stuff until a couple months before a project is complete. But with all the leeway and time frame of receiving stuff, we've been buying since day one of this project, just to house here on the campus, with warranties that won't start running until they go into the facility. But everything's on pace, and we're being able to purchase everything that we need. It's looking really good, Zartner said. The Odessa Downtown Project is also on pace. Located at the corner of 4th and Jackson Street, Phase 1 includes a large green space, a covered stance, two performance canopies, an entryway, a splash pad, restrooms, and parking for food vendors. Completion is expected at the end of April or first week of May. We hope to host a grand opening May 9th. The splash pad has been laid, concrete is going down, the green space should be any second, everything's going really well for downtown, Zartner said. He added that OC has just signed agreements with the contractor M&W Builders to build a covered amphitheater space that we build in the middle of the campus. It's about a six-month project. We're hoping by the fall that it will be done as well, Zartner said. The Rudy Acosta Pavilion is expected to be finished sometime between the fall and spring of 2024. It will be between the Learning Center, Library, Health Sciences Building, and Diedrich Hall. It will have a canopy area as well. We don't have a time frame on that, Zartner said. The electric lineman program will be across the street from the main campus. It's moving from the west campus to the Encore facility that should be ready for classrooms as soon as May or June. The lineman class is still at the west campus and should wrap up at the end of May or first week of June. When that's completed, we hope to transition the program here full-time across the street. That's a dirt lot area, and we put an 8-inch caliche fencing. We're going to have the lineman poles placed there strategically, and then we'll do some nice mesh covering around all of the fence lines to enclose it and also make it look much nicer, Zartner said. We have much better facilities here, so the students are able to have access to more Wi-Fi, more technology, better classroom spaces, all sorts of different things, he added. Having it on campus will allow it to be more visible to the community, he added. There are 19 students in the program now, and this could double the number. We want to see if we can operate more times throughout the day instead of just nights and weekends, Zartner said. He said they are fundraising for a pedestrian bridge that will cost about $1.5 million. But it's important to us because you can go current HSB facility right now anytime during the day, and you're going to see 7-8 rows of parking lots with no spaces available, Zartner said. We're expanding the facility to be 150% of what the facility is. Looking at our parking lot out here right now, there's no space. You now add 10, 12 rows of students, our employees are going to have to park across the street. We're going to have to find a way to bridge across the street to here in a safe manner. Just from the parking perspective, we've been able to acquire a couple of different lots of property across the street. One of the bigger lots was the older university apartment complex that we owned at one time, sold, and then we bought back and used currently as a construction site. That will be another parking facility. So as we move across the street, our programs, our CE, continuing education, our safety training, our library program, our cosmetology program, we really need to develop a gateway to our campus that's safe. Last week, we walked across the street to do training with 67 different employees at Williams Hall. Cars were running red lights left and right. It's just not safe. Some of these people are going 60 to 70 miles an hour down that way. We've seen it all the time. If we're going to ask people to park across the street, we're going to ask them all these things. We really need to give them that passage where they feel comfortable, he said. In the future, OC is looking at building a new academic building, as it's been called the Wilkerson II right now. That was directly south of the current Wilkerson facility. It's a beautiful concept design that we have. We know we can bring on more students. The need of housing is significant. We want to build additional housing complex, a four-story unit that can house up to 150 to 200 people, Zartner said. Long-term plans include building a new performance arts center where Diedrich currently sits. We have an old auditorium. We love to build a new facility there and go away from Diedrich and then use existing fine arts. For once again, parking, as we'll get rid of the building because it's reached its end of life. So a lot of parking big plans on the horizon, Zartner said. He said there's no concept design yet, as they're far off in the horizon, but there is a master plan for the campus, so how it's going to support students. We're at 8,082 students for the spring right now. The latest spring enrollment, the largest enrollment period in the history of the college, is a spring semester. When colleges usually see enrollment drop in the spring, we literally just broke an all-time record on top of an all-time record of 10 to 11 years at that point, Zartner said. Our campus infrastructure was really built for about 4,500 students. We've doubled the capacity inside, and then you add our two early college high schools, Odessa Collegiate Academy and OC Techs. That's 800-plus students walking around here all day. They need a place to eat, places to hang out, places to study, places to live on our campus. All those high school senior kids drive their own cars, Dartner said. It's really a good problem to have, and it's really good for our community as we try to educate all those folks as possible that we can, he added. Once they relocate all the facilities and students to the new health sciences building, they will remodel the current one, support the early college high schools. It would include additional spaces to eat and classrooms. Then they would go to their college class across the campus, which would free up the second, third floors of the LRC for more space and eventually be able to get Diedrich Auditorium up to be rebuilt. All those facilities are being used right now, but our current early college high school, Zettner said. He added that there's a lot of young minds to educate. We've grown so much, even from an employee perspective. You look at 10 years ago, and we're at 318. 19 full-time FTEs, now full staff. We're at 422. There's a lot more offices, a lot more people. When you double enrollment, though, you need to have the support staff around to support many more students. We're so fortunate and blessed to support our community and to have the success that we're currently having, but we're not stopping. Pets of the Week, Savannah. Savannah, a 10-month-old cat, needs to be adopted into a good home. To adopt Savannah or any other pets of the Humane Society of Odessa, stop by 7012 Mockingbird Lane. Call 432-257-4311. Visit odessahumanesociety.org or leave a message at facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa. The Humane Society of Odessa is a no-kill pet adoption center, and all the pets require spay, neuter, contract along with an adoption application. Adoption fees for pets start at $75. To help support ASO, donations are welcome at tinyurl.com/279URB4S. Donations will go towards kennels, cat houses, and adoption center. Buddy, a 2-year-old male bulldog mix, needs to be adopted into a good home. To adopt Buddy or any other pets at the Humane Society of Odessa, stop by 7012 Mockingbird Lane or call 432-257-4311. Visit odessahumanesociety.org or leave a message at facebook.com/Humane Society of Odessa.
People who get vaccine less likely to die. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach, Saturday, April 22nd, 2023. Dear Dr. Roach, in a recent column, you referred to a UK source that stated all-cause mortality is very significantly reduced in people who have had the COVID vaccine compared to unvaccinated people. I wasn't sure what you meant by all-cause. Does this mean any and all deaths with or without COVID for any reason have been very significantly reduced just by getting the COVID shot? Or does it mean that any and all deaths associated with COVID has been reduced in those who have been vaccinated? If it is the first, then fewer people should be dying, people should be living longer, and we should not see a decrease in life expectancy, except for the addition of those dying from COVID, which brings the age down. Anyway, if the first is true, then I will definitely continue getting the COVID shot just to live longer, with or without getting COVID. Answer. The UK study looked at all-cause mortality, which means anyone who dies from any reason. The study found that getting the COVID-19 vaccine reduced the likelihood of dying from COVID and non-COVID causes. One potential problem studies face is assigning cause of death. If a person with a very serious cancer who is expected to pass away within a few months gets COVID and dies, did the cancer kill them or did COVID? If you have to choose just one cause, the answer would be misleading. That's why the results of the UK study and a Florida study that showed similar results were so important. People who get the COVID-19 vaccine are less likely to die from any cause. In the last few years in the U.S., the long-standing trend of improved mortality has reversed, and death rates are going up, partially due to COVID.
Good morning. This is Jelaine Scott reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, April 22nd, 2023. Dear Abby, sounds of verbal abuse echo outside the walls. Dear Abby, I live on the bottom floor of a duplex with my wife. My brother-in-law, his wife, and their two sons, age 4 and 2, are upstairs. Since the 2-year-old was born, he's been very rambunctious and fussy. I consider my brother-in-law a good parent overall, but for a while now, I hear him blow up, scream, curse, and shout at the younger child. I don't think it's healthy. I have a hard time with it because of my upbringing, which left a mark. I grew up in a home ruled by intimidation. I am also a school counselor. The 4-year-old has a pronounced speech impediment that I'm hoping the school will help with. As an adult and someone who works with kids, it bothers me to hear this go on every day in our home. I wouldn't dare to say anything to my brother-in-law or sister-in-law. I'm just worried about the boys. Will they be okay? Please let me know what to do. We all want my nephews to be well, but I can't blur the line between counselor and aunt. Full of concern in the East. Dear Fool, nothing will change unless you find the courage to speak out. Involve your wife in this. Both of you should talk to your brother-in-law and sister-in-law about how being intimidated from an early age affected your life. Suggest that if the kids are becoming more than your brother-in-law can handle, he find a way to take a break from them until he calms down. The school may be able to help the older boy with his speech impediment, and you should make sure that the help is requested. Beyond this, there's nothing more you can do to change the unhealthy dynamic upstairs. Dear Abby, I was in a relationship for 48 years. We lived together for 15 years, were married for 30 years, and divorced 3 years ago. We have one married child who has 3 children. Not all of our years together were glorious. We had our share of problems, and we just grew apart. Yes, we slept in the same bed and went on vacations, but there was no intimacy for a good 20 years. I would have to ask him for a hug or a kiss, which he would give, but I didn't feel loved. I love him, but I'm no longer in love with him. I help him anytime he asks. We live in the same town. I'm now wondering if our current relationship is a convenience. We share a meal a couple of times a week, and he calls or texts almost daily, but he doesn't want me around his current group of friends. I have my own outside interests, but I'm trying to figure out where I stand in his life. I think I'm okay with a friendship with him. We're both retired. For the record, I have no desire to date, nor do I want to put myself in that position. I dislike being out by myself after dark. Advice, please. Moved on in New Mexico. Dear Moved On, if you want to know where you stand in your ex-husband's life, ask him. From my long-distance perspective, the two of you have 4 decades plus of mutual experiences, and it's a relationship that has value. If you derive some pleasure from it, why throw it away? However, if maintaining a relationship with him prevents you from moving on in your own life, concentrate on widening your circle of friends and growing forward independently.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.